What's up, my sweetly scented carenips? My name is Jessie, and welcome to my podcast, Tea with the Gods. In today's episode, we're going to go over some terminology. I gathered together the terms I get asked about frequently, also ones that I feel like are quite common and important to know. Most of them are ancient Greek terms, which means they can be a bit tricky to define. So some terms may have longer explanations than others. This small list is in no way all the terms relevant to Hellenic polytheism, especially if you choose to go down the Reconstructionist route. There's plenty more, but like I said, I find these to be the ones you will come across the most and will need for your own worship. To make following along a lot easier, I included a list of the terms I'll be covering in the description. I know sometimes it's easier to register words, especially those from another language, when you can visually see them. All right, loves, how about you go grab yourself some tea and let's learn some ancient Greek terms, shall we? So the first word we're going to talk about is theoi, which is an ancient Greek word that translates to the gods. You use this when you're referring to all the gods at once. Theos is used when you're referring to one god. Our next term is offering. I'll be doing a whole episode very soon on the nature of offerings and how to exactly do it, but for now, just know that they are something you give to the gods to show your gratitude and devotion. An example of an offering is the ancient Greek term libation, which is basically liquid that's poured out as an offering to the gods. Our next term is miasma. This is a very difficult term to define since we don't really have a translation for it in English. The word itself also holds so much more than a simple definition could ever convey. And to further complicate matters, everyone has their own view and opinion on how to define it and what exactly constitutes as miasmic. Basically, it's an annoyingly complicated term. But I'm here to define terms for you, and to define terms I shall do. So here's my definition. Miasma can be translated as pollution, but not just physical pollution. Miasma can also exist emotionally and spiritually. Now, I know using the word pollution paints a pretty icky picture of miasma, but the reality is that it's not actually seen as a bad thing or an evil thing. It just sort of is. Miasma comes from just being human and doing human things. So there's no way to avoid it, and it's not something to be ashamed of. It is also something that you don't necessarily need to believe in or apply to your worship. When I first started, I had no concept of miasma, and it didn't stop me from forming a connection with Aphrodite. Even now, despite knowing about miasma, I still never applied it to my devotion, and honestly, I'm happy about that. Why, you may ask? Well, some of us already struggle with our realities as human beings. We have mental illnesses, chronic illnesses, disabilities, traumas, insecurities, and other very human things that we're trying to manage, cope with, and accept. I worry that for some people, incorporating the concept of miasma into their worship could have a negative impact. That it might cause them to look down on their struggles and make them think that because of those struggles, they are undeserving of the gods. It could keep them from going to their altars and praying when they are in a dark place, or even forming a relationship in the first place. And that's truly heartbreaking to me, because it's moments like that when you need to be at your altar. You need to be at the feet of the gods, releasing your turmoil and pain to them. There shouldn't be a barrier that prevents you from seeking solace, comfort, and love from the gods. Again, I just want to reiterate that miasma isn't a bad thing. What I'm talking about is the way we choose to use the concept. Like, come on, we all know how our brains can be. They take something harmless and turn it into a weapon designed to beat us down. I don't want this to turn into such a weapon, so I encourage you to be honest with yourself. Don't bring anything into your worship that could create barriers instead of dismantling them. Okay, so what if you do decide to incorporate miasma into your worship? Thankfully, the ancient Greeks had a way to cleanse yourself of miasma, which leads us to our next term, kernips. The ancient Greek way to cleanse yourself of anything miasmic before engaging the gods. Typically, turnips is made by lighting a match or an herb of some kind and dropping it into a bowl of water. So the next terms we're going to talk about are patron and matron. I get asked about these two constantly. These terms confuse the hell out of basically everyone, mainly because there's multiple definitions. I'm going to give you the two most common ones. The first being that a patron deity is seen as the god you have the deepest bond with, the main god in your practice or devotion. This definition is used primarily by the pagan and witch communities. The second definition is the one that is mostly used within the Hellenic community, which sees a patron deity as the god or gods who rule over your profession and/or role you play in your family or community. So if you're a marine biologist, then cool bro, Poseidon would be your patron. If you're a sex worker, then Aphrodite would be your patron deity. If you're a bank robber, then definitely Hermes is your guy. And what's nice about this definition is that you can have multiple patron deities to fit your profession in different roles. So like, let's say you're a sex worker, but you're also a mom. You can have both Aphrodite and Hera as your patron deities. If you're a trans dude who's going to art school, Dionysus, Athena, and Apollo. Boom! Look at that! Three patrons! Also, know that patron deities don't have to be a lifetime gig, especially with the last definition. We change careers, we go through different life stages, so it's pretty likely your patrons will change. And that's okay. It's also very important to know that you don't have to have a patron or matron deity. I don't have one, and as far as I can tell, I'm doing quite all right. So it's completely up to you. Oh, and as a side note, you might have noticed that I barely use the term matron. That's because patron is a gender-neutral term and can be used for a god or goddess. But again, if you feel like using matron to refer to your goddess, then do your thing, chicken wing. Next, I'm going to go over the differences between the words follower, worshiper, devotee, and working. Follower and worshiper are general terms for people who worship the gods in any capacity. They can be used interchangeably. A devotee is different from a follower and worshiper in that it's generally a deeper level of commitment. Think of going from dating to a more serious relationship, or from friends to best friends. When you devote yourself to a god, you're making a promise to them. A promise to make them a priority in your life. So it is something that I wouldn't recommend jumping into right away. But don't worry, there will be a whole episode on becoming a devotee where I'll explain more. So working is a term that has a few different meanings depending on who's using it. Firstly, it's used by worshipers and devotees to refer to any problems or issues being worked through, any healing being done, or if their god is helping manifest something in their life. So you could say you're working on your self-confidence with Aphrodite, or you're working through trauma with Persephone. The second definition describes the relationship between a non-worshipper and a god. This basically refers to witches who will work with a god to achieve a certain goal and then part ways once that goal is met. It's a working relationship that's meant to be temporary. And the third is the simplest of them all, which is that it can be used interchangeably with following or worship. The last term we're going to talk about is hubris. Hubris is the closest thing Hellenics have to the concept of sin, though hubris actually is nothing like sin. It's seen as extreme pride that defies, challenges, and offends the gods. A lot of Greek mythology deals with the concept of hubris, which is why the gods tend to be so cruel in the myths. There's a lesson being taught. Kind of like how Bible stories are used to teach certain beliefs or concepts. We'll talk more in depth about the roles of myths in a later episode. But to give you an idea, here are some examples of hubris and how the gods chose to punish those who commit it. Everyone boasting about how Adonis's mother Smyrna's beauty rivaled that of Aphrodite's, to which Aphrodite responded by causing Smyrna to sleep with her dad. Because Aphrodite don't play. Arachne declaring to be a better weaver than Athena, which prompted Athena to turn her into a spider. And who could forget the man-baby himself, Agamemnon, who refused to give back the daughter of one of Apollo's priests. So Apollo, like a beautiful ball of golden rage, brought a nasty plague down on Agamemnon's troops. You gotta admit, the gods are pretty creative with their punishments. A little unfair, kind of misogynistic, but creative. Now, what does all this mean for you, the modern day worshiper? Well, you don't have to worry about Athena turning you into a spider, or Aphrodite making you have the hots for your dad. Ew. But it is very important that regardless of the relationship you develop with the gods, you remember that they are still gods. They are divine, powerful, golden, and absolute. We are pretty great ourselves in our own strange, complicated, messy ways, but we're not gods. We're not, and never will be, on their level. So as long as you remember that, you'll be fine. And that's all I got. I didn't want to bombard you with a crap load of terms. You know, this isn't school. But I hope this episode proved very helpful and even enjoyable. Next episode, I will be giving some tips and advice to keep in mind as you get started. So I hope you'll join me then. As always, thank you so very much for listening, and I'll see you guys next time. Bye!